KALW.
So there will be some hygiene, like toilets, I think showers brought in on a regular basis, hand washing stations.
A new center opens in the Tenderloin to help people who are struggling with drugs and mental health.
And people could sit and rest. It's not intended to be an overnight shelter. The goal is that they could connect people to services.
We'll hear about the new Linkage Center on Market Street, part of the Mental Health SF legislation passed 2 years ago. Then we'll examine Sacramento's historic Sutter's Fort.
We missed the truth, and we missed the impact on Native American people. Native culture was either diminished or distorted or inappropriately represented.
And San Jose cookbook author Beth Lee reads to us about Jewish baking. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. This morning, a new center on Market Street opened to connect people in the Tenderloin District with services ranging from mental health care to housing. And it follows Mayor London Breed's declaration of a state of emergency in the neighborhood because of overdose deaths. This linkage center is part of what the city envisioned 2 years ago as part of Mental Health SF, legislation that aimed to fix the city's broken mental health and substance use treatment system. So what else was the legislation supposed to do, and is it happening? Reporter Mallory Mensch covers City Hall for the San Francisco Chronicle. She joined me to explain, and she started with describing the new Linkage Center.
Essentially, anyone can walk in off the street, or if an outreach worker goes and meets someone, they can transport them to this center, and people can basically get whatever they need. So there will be some hygiene, like toilets, I think showers brought in on a regular basis, hand washing stations, food, coffee, that kind of thing. And people could sit and rest. It's not intended to be an overnight shelter. The goal is that they could connect people to services. So it could mean that someone basically just comes in, warms up, gets a cup of coffee, and leaves again. People can leave whenever they want. Or the goal really is that then they would go and talk to a caseworker and say, actually, you know, I don't have anywhere to stay for the night. And then they try to get them in a shelter. Or how can we get you on a list or assessed so that you could get longer term housing? Or do you need treatment? Or do you have a medical issue that we need to address? So the goal is that they would all be in one place so they could send them around to different rooms or different floors and try and get them connected. There still is the question, of course, which Mental Health SF brought up, that do we actually have the resources to send these people to? And I'm still assessing that, getting some data from the health department on exactly how many beds they have and how great the need is. But that was also a key aspect of Mental Health SF that the city is still working on, that they have not gotten all the beds and the resources that they want yet.
So that's part of what Mental Health SF was calling for. Can you remind us what else did Mental Health SF promise?
Mental Health SF was a very broad legislation that was really looking to do four main things. One was to fund more beds and programs, more places for people to get treatment who were struggling with mental health and also with substance use. It also aimed to have more mental health professionals respond to some 911 calls of someone who might be in crisis on the streets. So to have those mental health care workers instead of police respond. And then there were two other big pieces, and both of these were aimed at creating a more cohesive system, because the system has right now and still does has a lot of different city departments and a lot of different nonprofits. It's pretty disjointed. It can be hard to get in treatment or to connect and to follow people to make sure they're getting what they need. So those two pieces were to create an Office of Coordinated Care, to have case managers who are bringing people together and following them through the system, and then to also have a physical mental health center, a one-stop shop where anyone could come in off the streets or from anywhere else in the city and get access to the help that they need and get connected quickly.
In one of your recent articles about this, you just asked the question, San Francisco embraced a plan to reform broken mental health care 2 years ago. Has it helped? And we have this new linkage center on Market Street. What else has happened as part of implementing Mental Health SF?
So the city did start these teams. They call them street crisis response teams of mental health professionals that go out in response to some lower level police calls, 911 calls that don't involve people who are violent or have a weapon. These are people who are exhibiting signs of being in a crisis. So they send mental health professionals instead to meet them and to try to help them. So they have rolled those out. Now they have a number that across the city that are running overnight as well. They've been slowly expanding them over this past year. That's been in place since November 2020. And then they also have gotten some of the beds that they wanted. And this is a longer-term plan. So they wanted to add about 400 treatment beds. And they've opened, at last count, 87. So they're, you know, a little less than a quarter of the way there. And that includes a center where people can go. It's called a psychiatric respite center. So if they're having a crisis, they can go in that place. It's not so much urgent care or medical treatment, but where they could calm down and receive some help and care. So some beds like that.
You've talked to a lot of people and you ask the central question of, has it worked? And a lot of people are talking about Mayor London Breed's emergency actions, including a lot of controversy around policing. What's your assessment? Who's happy with the progress and who's not?
Mayor London Breed has come out with a lot of new initiatives specifically focused on the Tenderloin. So that in itself is a complicated and controversial proposal, since she also wants more police enforcement of laws on the streets of the Tenderloin. The politicians who authored this law, who authored Mental Health SF, being Supervisor Hillary Ronan and Supervisor Matt Haney, they do not like some of the policing aspects of what the mayor is doing, but they've expressed that they're very hopeful and excited that this will actually move forward some pieces of Mental Health SF. They've been super frustrated that the things that they wanted to bring the system together are not happening. So I think they're hopeful that with this new approach that's led by the Department of Emergency Management, trying to bring everyone together, trying to see where things are duplicative, where you have 20 outreach teams that are going out in the Tenderloin, you know, how can we bring them together? How can we make sure that people get connected to services quickly? So I think there is a feeling that they are hopeful because the city is really laser focusing in on this and also putting more investment into speeding up the process. And they're saying, well, that's great because we've been asking for it for 2 years or longer than 2 years.
Mallory Mensch is a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. We've got a link to all her coverage at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Sutter's Fort is historic. It was central to Gold Rush history, as well as the development of the city of Sacramento, and it helped shape California as we know it today. But what isn't as well known is how this all came at a great cost to indigenous people. To help tell that lesser-known history of the fort, state parks have been working with local tribes over the past year to create a more accurate narrative about the violence Native peoples suffered during colonial times. From Sacramento and our friends at Capital Public Radio, Pauline Bartoloni brings us this story.
Tens of thousands of kids have shuffled through this fort about a mile from the state capitol every year. Until recently, they may have reenacted characters from the 1800s and interacted with park staff dressed up in colonial attire. But John Frazier of California State Parks says that way of telling colonial history fails in one major way.
We missed the truth, and we missed the impact on Native American people. Native culture was either diminished or distorted or inappropriately represented.
Frazier says the State Parks Agency, which runs the fort, was too narrowly focused on a heroic narrative about the Swiss settler John Sutter. So for the past year, they've been collaborating with several local Native American tribes to tell a fuller picture of his impact on Miwok and Nisenan people.
He destroyed so much of our culture and history and just took over, you know, lands.
Rhonda Pope Flores is the chairwoman of the Buena Vista Rancheria of Miwok Indians in Amador County. She says John Sutter violently disrupted indigenous ways of life.
People moved away and killed and slaughtered and enslaved. And that is very different from what you would find at Sutter's Fort.
Historians have documented Sutter's killing and exploitation of Native Americans. One account describes hundreds of Native people working for him in slave-like conditions, eating out of troughs for livestock. He shelled indigenous villages and trafficked Native American workers. That's according to his biographer, Albert Hurtado.
He had no compunction about taking some men and a cannon and shelling an Indian rancheria, killing people indiscriminately.
However, Hurtado says, John Sutter was a complicated man. He preferred to use diplomacy before violence, and he was the founder of Sacramento. He was hospitable to new settlers, and he even tried to save the Donner Party.
And you have to show him in all of his different facets.
Californians are not the only ones renaming or reinterpreting public areas with an equity lens. Autumn Saxton Ross of the National Recreation and Park Association says around the U.S., people are rethinking parks, bridges, and statues, too.
So I can have a park across the street for me, but if it's named Robert E. Lee as a black woman, that drives certain feelings. So maybe I'm not comfortable in that park.
Saxton Ross says recasting the stories around these common spaces is necessary for racial healing.
If we are going to tell history, it needs to be accurate. So we have to actually recognize that things sucked for a really long time, and we pretend as if it didn't.
In the new year, California Parks Department will invite the public to participate in meetings about how to reinterpret Sutter's Fort.
It's a long time coming for this history to really be corrected.
Tribal Chairwoman Pope Flores says she's proud to be part of shaping the new narrative. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartoloni.
That story was produced by our friends at Capital Public Radio. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, we're going to hear from a San Jose cookbook author. It's another episode from KALW's literary podcast, New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Beth Lee lives in San Jose. Her book, The Essential Jewish Baking Cookbook, came out in August.
The book is all about learning to bake the Jewish recipes you grew up with, or maybe the ones your bubby or grandma made, or the ones you want your own family to grow up eating. Here's one of my favorite parts from the introduction. Baking and eating are integral to Jewish culture and traditions. Think of challah for Shabbat, cookies at an oneg, the sweets table at a wedding or bar or bat mitzvah, Berekis or boyo at a family brunch, or the cinnamon-scented coffee cake you dream about all day in temple as you eagerly await breaking the fast on Yom Kippur. Or maybe your memories include a tishpishti or sponge cake to end a festive Seder meal. But if, like me, you didn't learn to bake growing up, you can still build that tradition into your own family kitchen. Perhaps you don't identify as Jewish yourself, but are married to or live with someone who does, and you want to learn more about Jewish culinary traditions. This book will be your own file of recipes, both new and old, so you can bake for your spouse, partner, or friends.
That was Beth Lee reading from The Essential Jewish Baking Cookbook. New Arrivals is produced by KALW Public Radio.
New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse, and there's more Bay Area authors reading from their new books at klw.org/newarrivals. Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We're going to talk about being autistic and Black. When most people hear about autistic diagnosis, they think about kids. But in the Black community, there's a good chance you won't be diagnosed as autistic until you're grown up.
The research 40 years ago exclusively was white boys, so it left out girls and women altogether.
We'll hear from Diane Wright, a biracial Black woman who now works as an autism advocate and media consultant. Diane herself is autistic and was also diagnosed late as an adult.
In the last handful of years, quite literally, like handful of years, that's begun to change. But still, when you're overlooked and left out, as you know, that shapes the policy of the places you live in, that shapes the attitudes of the society you live in. You cease to exist for a lot of reasons.
The barriers to identifying autism in the Black community. That's tomorrow at 5. And from San Francisco, here's our local music for today. This is the band Ice Cream, and they'll be playing in the city this Sunday at Bottom of the Hill. Today's Cross Currents team includes Dorothy Tang, Johanna Miyaki, James Rollins, Gabe Graben, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.